Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, September 15th. My name is Magnus Tiewold, and joining me in the studio today is...
Peter R.H.
And we got a bunch of stuff lined up for you today. Thanks for tuning in here at CJSF 90.1 FM. We appreciate you joining us for this hour. We got a couple stories for you here. Recently, the federal government announced that the Carney government announced that they would be making very deep cuts to the ministry or the Department of Women and Gender, 80% cuts. And we have a story from our friends in Montreal about reaction to that. We also have a story about... some controversy around RCMP traffic stops in northern BC. And a bunch of other stuff as well. We have, of course, our regular feature of Gardening with Embark. And Peter, what are you going to be talking about today?
I'm going to be talking about solar power. Because I heard on Democracy Now! The last week, they were talking a bit about how we sort of blocked and all that. But the thing about solar power, it can only go so far. I think what they're talking about is having it 25%. I mean, I'm talking about globally. It's going to be 25% of all power. Mm-hmm. And I think sort of the rhetoric at times is that, oh, it's being blocked. Oh, usually it's right-wing conspiracy, but kind of a left-wing conspiracy at times. Oh, they're blocking solar. But I think it can only go so far as such. But I'm going to be going about sort of what's going to be the future with energy and so on.
Excellent.
The future.
All right. Well, let's get into our first story in a minute. Couple of big things in the news, of course, were the assassination of Charlie Kirk last week and the very diverse reactions to that, particularly throughout the United States. In many ways, emphasizing the increasing political divisions down there. Of course, many people, I don't know if I'd say celebrate, but certainly felt it important to point out just what he stood for. You know, many on the left and on the right, there's a real attempt to... I can hear you crackling away there, Peter.
Oh, I shouldn't be putting my stylist in plastic bags.
Especially super crackly plastic bags.
Well, it's a bit of magic.
So that's been something that's happening, and the Trump administration and its various members of cabinet have been threatening many people online who've been not saying nice things about Charlie Kirk, which is very, just sort of an odd thing for an administration that loves to talk about, and a right-wing movement that loves to talk about freedom and respect for the Constitution.
Oh, it's about their freedom.
It is very much about freedom for them and not for anyone else. Rules for thee, but not for me.
Well, Citizen Kane, there's a scene where his friend actually loses the governor of New York, whatever, mm-hmm. the fictional character Charles Foster. He said, "You only want love on your own terms." And then Charles Foster Kane says, "That's the only terms anybody wants them." He finally admits it. So it's like, oh, it's just, you want it your way. That's bait what it comes down to. But you know this, what's the first name? It's Kirk, Charles Kirk.
Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk. He said, well, I'm for a few gun deaths because that's the price we pay for gun rights.
Mm-hmm.
So ironically, he was part of his crusade then, I guess, for gun rights.
And yeah, I mean, somebody said he died for what he.
I'm sort of
advocated for, in a way, in a sort of weird, ironic way.
I'm sort of more sympathetic to other people dying because of the Trump administration right now, and a variety of people are dying. I mean, it's not. I mean, you know, there's no need to be happy about this person dying.
No, and
but
I think
he was still nasty as hell. He was a nasty person. That's what the truth is about him.
And I think it's important to note that, you know, we're not advocating for or, you know, condoning political violence. And I think that's really important because it never really leads to good things, you know. And you can see that effect happening in the U.S. right now where, you know, various sides, but I would say particularly the right, you know, are really trying to exploit this incident, you know, to sow greater division and to attack their political enemies, even to the point of, you know, almost as soon as it happened and well before anyone even knew who the suspect was or anything about him, you know, they were already attacking and blaming their political adversaries, blaming the Democrats and blaming the left and, you know, often in quite vitriolic and aggressive language. And as we learn a bit more about the shooter, you know, far from being, and I want to emphasize, it's still not a great deal of clarity, but, you know, he certainly would appear to be someone primarily from the right. I mean, he comes from a established Republican family, you know, had that kind of upbringing, appears to have been somewhat radicalized in some fashion. But the idea that you can say, you know, somehow it's the Democrats' fault is pretty making stuff up.
Yeah. He kind of furthered the cause, the assassin of Charlie Kirk. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could have been still very more critical of the person in general by him staying alive. So I don't know.
Yeah. It was. And you know, particularly, you know, I think the comments of Trump, you know, traditionally the president and really any government leader in a situation like this, you know, one of the things they would traditionally do is try and call for calm and to make a public statement aimed at reducing tensions around the incident and within the country. And Donald Trump has used this as an opportunity to do the opposite and just, you know, with his statements and you know, attack the left and attack the Democrats and lay a lot of blame around without justification. And in many ways, I think really irresponsible it is irresponsible, but I think it also serves his purpose of creating more division that he can exploit within the country.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think it was a bad idea to assassinate Charlie Kirk. As I say, it makes an excuse to be sympathetic towards him, more so than certain of his fans were. So, but the people were like, sometimes it's just an emotional thing. He saw an opportunity. Probably wanted to assassinate Trump as opposed to Charlie Kirk, but he was there. So, I mean, as I said, it sort of kind of goes in his what Charlie Kirk's rhetoric was. It kind of serves the purpose by the assassination, and you can't have it. You can't just say, "Oh, well, we don't like this guy's opinion; he should die." So that's not the kind of society.
Well, that's not how we work. That's not how we work in democracy.
But he's still, I'm not going to like the guy.
No,
I mean, I'm going to, and to say, well, the fact that you don't like him means that you're whatever it is. I'm being dangerous by not liking him.
It's a dangerous statement in itself. You know, I mean, basically, they're working to try and suppress people's opinions around it. And, you know, apparently a lot of people have been fired, whether in media, but also in various government jobs. And, you know, sometimes people have made pretty rash and intemperate statements that were probably not very wise to make. But a lot of times it seems to have been pretty measured statements that simply called out Charlie Kirk for things he said in his own words.
Yeah. No, it's... I don't... Was he all that of a major figure?
He was pretty big deal. I mean, I didn't... You know, I'm not following all those right-wing people very closely because it, you know... But, you know, he's one of the people who got mentioned a lot. You know, there was him and Ben Shapiro and others sort of in that, you know, right-wing influencers who seem to be pretty significant, you know, and, you know, pretty significant, particularly in the case of Charlie Kirk, but I also think maybe Ben Shapiro as well, in mobilizing young men to the MAGA movement.
Okay, well, I hadn't really heard of him previously myself, but anyway.
Closer to home, the Mark Carney's government is getting preparing for a budget, and they're also making a number of significant spending announcements. Big housing, over $4 billion housing plan has been announced, and of course, along with other NATO nations, a significant expansion in defense spending. Also, some cuts. And that budget is going to be coming pretty soon, and they've hinted at it's going to have a pretty substantial deficit, which will something they'll be pretty harshly attacked by the conservatives about, I'm sure. One of the cuts they've made is to... the Department of Women and Gender. And this story here from our colleagues in the Local Journalism Initiative program in Montreal is all about that and some of the reaction to that, an over 80% reduction in the budget for that department. So here's that story. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Federally, Canada's Department for Women and Gender Equality, the WAGE, is facing budget cuts of 80% in their recently released departmental plan. The WAGE is a federal department committed to advancing equality with respect to sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression through the inclusion of people of all genders, including women, in Canada's economic, social, and political life. So there are a number of things the WAGE does. They create informational resources on gender equality. They provide reports on gender-based violence, provide consultation to other bodies of government, and overall set a standard for women and gender equality at the federal level. One of the more significant things the department does, which we feel at the community level, is provide funding, grants, and funding for organizations that focus on gender equality. As it stands, the WAGE's total budget, which represents 0.08% of the total federal expenditures, will fall to 0.01% by 2027, and staffing levels are expected to decline by 35.2% in the sector. So certain groups like the YWCA are circulating petitions about this budget cut, talking about how this could undermine the national and local feminist organizations, shelters, sexual assault services, victim services. So sitting with us in studio today is a representative from one of these organizations, the group Women Aware, which is a group that assists and empowers survivors who have experienced intimate partner violence. Clara, welcome to the show. Do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Women Aware?
Hi, thank you. I really appreciate you folks having us here again. We've, you know, done a lot of stuff with you guys in the past, and we love being back. It's just unfortunate that we have to talk about this, but we do. For those of you who are just tuning in and may have not heard of Women Aware and what we do, my name is Claire Levesque. I'm the Vice President of Women Aware, Femme Avertie. We're a Montreal-based organization, a nonprofit that is run by survivors for survivors of intimate partner violence. And we service folks across Canada. You don't need to necessarily be in Montreal for us to service you. We have clients that are in BC, that are in Nova Scotia and stuff like that, that we service on our helpline, on our hotline, and also on in our one-on-one programs. So those are like some of the services that we offer. Our first line of contact is our hotline, where we have people that can either refer you to different resources. We have active listening trained individuals. We also have a one-on-one peer support service where we listen to the survivors and what their needs are, what their case is, and then they could be paired with somebody that has a similar lived experience. And we also have group support, among other things. We do advocacy. We do sensitization or sensibilization of what gender-based violence is to the general public. So we do a variety of things, and we're there on the front lines working with survivors, but we're also there trying to prevent, you know, this from being a common day experience, whether it be with high school individuals or with partner organizations that don't know how to intervene. We're there. So
part of what you do, not just listening sessions and support, but also information campaigns.
Yeah. Right. So like, you know, if say a family member of a survivor calls our hotline and they're like, hey, yeah, I have a cousin who's experiencing this and it's been ongoing. I have no idea what to do. How do I support them? Because it's killing me seeing them, you know, go through this. And, you know, we can give them advice. We can refer to them to different resources for both their mental health, but also to, you know, do's and don'ts in that situation, because we don't want to further put the survivor in a situation of unsafety, and we don't want them to also shut down and then not want to keep in contact with the person that's trying to help them, because that'll sometimes happen, right? Is, you know, the cycle of isolation. That's exactly what an abuser wants. They want their person that they've chosen to feel alone. So we do things like that, but we also go to, like I said, partner organizations. So like, say, for example, somebody mainly works with, like you guys were talking about, substance abuse, people who experience substance abuse. Sometimes there's a lot of overlap with people who are survivors of conjugal violence or intimate partner violence. So if they don't know how to kind of, or they're not trained in how to address that from a trauma-informed perspective, they can partner with us to have training.
I'm wondering for the aspect of helping someone who's going through this as like a bystander or a cousin or a friend. How do you do it? Because it's very difficult. It's very much a mental health game for these people, these victims that are going through it. It's, and as you say, mm-hmm. it's like a manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it. It's very difficult to I wouldn't say reason with someone who's going through it, because it's mm-hmm. very difficult, and I understand that. But there's how do you do it to not be isolated, to not lose contact with the person? Because, of course, it's not ultimately their choice. It's a very difficult situation
mm-hmm.
That people don't realize they're being manipulated. It's not your cousin's fault. It's not your friend's fault who may be going through a situation.
Yeah.
So how do you tell someone who wants to intervene how to intervene in a respectful way that could maybe push the victim out of the situation, or even just keep the connection of staying friends and having mm-hmm. a support system?
I really appreciate that question, because, you know, it's exactly questions like that for the reason why I disagree vehemently in so many other women's organizations across Canada with the budget cuts that are expected, the 80% across the next several years against gender-based violence initiative, because there are, you know, what you're describing is what you call vicarious violence. So for those of you who don't know the definition of what vicarious violence is, when somebody who's very close and emotionally invested in somebody who is directly experiencing the violence witnesses it in some way, shape, or form, and then they, because they have, empathy, they feel the anguish, what you're describing, those feelings of deep pain seeing them this way. So friends can experience vicarious violence. Roommates can experience vicarious violence. Children can experience vicarious violence when we're talking about domestic violence, if they're seeing their parents, but they're not directly getting the violence per se. And where are the mental health resources for that? So I just wanted to kind of like mention that, is that these are the types of things that are going to get affected in terms of funding. And that's going to put a damper, that's going to put more strain on both the health system, on our economic system, and on the judiciary system. It's all interconnected. So to invest in gender-based violence initiatives and the fight against gender-based violence initiatives, it's tied together. But to circle back to your question, how do you support someone who is experiencing, and somebody who is experiencing that? What we always recommend is, you know, the best, biggest thing, first thing you can do is document everything from afar. You know, obviously don't tell the person that you're documenting it, because the thing is, when the person is in it, they're not thinking about that. They're just thinking about making it through the day, making it through the hour sometimes. And that can take many different forms. And so sometimes just documenting the day, the time, something that happened, like, for example, say, in the example of being a cousin, you notice that, or your cousin disclosed to you, oh yeah, you know, he yelled at me today. He called me an effing this. And then he proceeded to throw out my favorite painting. You can document that for them. And then after that, once they're ready to exit the relationship, but they can't for some reason recall or remember the instances of abuse, you have that for them. You're like, hey, I witnessed this with you. And so that's an example. As you know, as I mentioned, we're a survivor-run organization. You know, when I was in my past abusive relationship, you know, I did eventually keep some texts. I have a lot of them. And I have emails and everything like that, call logs. But something I remember was my old landlady, you know, and, you know, I didn't feel comfortable ever going to the police about it. But, you know, she came up to me once I exited, and when she confirmed that I exited and saw I was in an abusive relationship, she's like, you know, I documented. I heard everything that happened through the floorboards, and I documented everything. If ever you want that or need that, I have it here for you. I felt very unnerved by it at the time. So, you know, I was just fresh getting out of it. So that's also its timing. So as a supporter, try to gauge the timing, and that's very hard to do, but see where the person is emotionally. So that can take the form of, you know, what we call active listening, and it could take the form of asking them, how do you feel at this point in time about talking about this? Do you ever feel you would go to the police? And if their answer right away is no, then maybe it's not the right time to say, oh, by the way, I have evidence, you know? And the best thing you can do is ask. And to just ask questions, facilitate a discussion with a survivor, that might look like, how did that make you feel when he threw out that favorite painting of yours? And just by you validating their feelings and telling them, hey, that sounds like a really painful experience. You know, if somebody had done that to me, I would have probably went crying in the bathroom. You know, you're telling them, yeah, that's not okay. And I'm here with you. And I want to hear about what you're going through, because I believe it's not okay. Something mm-hmm. as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of answers and resources that Women Aware provide for people, mm-hmm. and the partner organizations you work with as well. So can you tell us a little bit about your fears when it comes to this budget cut? What might your organization and the partner organizations you work with look like if we were to see a reduction in these grants, if the money were to stop coming at the federal level?
Well, I mean, we're already feeling the effects. Like, we risk, you know, closing our doors if we don't find funding quickly within the next, you know, several months. So, you know, if you are good at grant writing, please do reach out to us. If you want to donate, please do reach out to us. You can call us at 514-489-1110. We're open Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. If not, you can also email us at info@womenaware.ca. We do have a charitable organization registered number on our website as well, so you can check that for donations and whatnot, monetary donations specifically. What can that look like? Well, it just means that we won't be able to stay open and continue running by survivors for survivors. There's very, very few organizations across Canada like ours that exist. We're very unique in that sense. But just to kind of give you some numbers, in the judiciary system alone, it costs about an estimated $7.4 billion to deal with the aftermath of spousal abuse. Now, when we're talking about those billions of dollars, what can that look like? Well, I mentioned part of it, vicarious violence, psychological services, and things like that. It could look like the incarceration system. It can look like persecutions, courts, legal aid, which oftentimes survivors don't have equitable access to because they're in situations of financial need or whatnot. It might look like child protection services, protection orders, like what do you call those?
Restraining orders.
Restraining orders. Thank you. I was having a blank right there. Separations and divorces. And these things extend over years. So that's what risks happening, because programs like that, where certain legal aid programs across Canada and Quebec were helping survivors, might risk getting their funding cut because wage helped out with that. Other aspects of gender-based violence that could be affected by it is also part of wage was to invest more in the intersectional aspect of how gender-based violence disproportionately affects people, because when we talk gender-based violence in the past, it was always happening to cis women. So a lot of services that were just starting to address LGBTQIA people are affected, people with disabilities are disproportionately affected, programs like that risk getting their funding cut. And especially when we're talking about medical abuse and people living with disabilities, there aren't very many resources across Canada that address the intersection of that. So how are we doing them justice and service by cutting this funding to them? It's all interconnected. And like I said, it's going to be a domino effect. It's not just, this is nice to have, as an open letter that was circulated stated. This is vital. This is life or death for people.
So we're sitting here live in studio with Clara from Women Aware, and we're discussing budget cuts to gender equality initiatives and gender-based violence initiatives. And you were saying that there were a few more statistics you wanted to share with us before the hour ends.
Yeah, so just a little trigger warning to folks. I know this has been a very heavy episode, but I am going to share some numbers related to deaths and things like that in a moment. So if you do need to take a moment to walk out of the room, take a moment. I know this is heavy. Alone in 2024, femicides in Canada affected about 187 women and girls that were reported and that were violently killed. And I say reported, it's very important, because this is not including the missing and murdered Indigenous women. This is not including women who gender-based violence where people took their own lives because they felt that there was no other option. They had no way out. So those things don't tend to get reported. That represents a 27% increase in femicide cases compared to 2023. So I highly implore the government to reconsider that decision. If this were some of their children,